This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Listeners, you're listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies. We're your host, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier. And we are so excited about this interview we have for you today. We are joined by Jonathan Spector, who is a playwright based in Oakland, California. His play, Eureka Day, which was a New York Times critic's pick and received all of the San Francisco Bay Area's New Play Awards, the Glickman Award, Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Award, Theater Bay Area Award, and Rella Lossi Award. This and other plays, including This Much I Know, What Comes Next, and Siesta Key, have been produced and developed across the country. He's also a McDowell Colony Fellow, a core writer at Playwright Center in Minneapolis, and a recipient of South Coast Rep's Elizabeth George Commission. In October, his audio drama, The Flats, which is co-written with Lauren Gunderson and Cleavon Smith, will premiere with Aurora Theater. Jonathan, welcome to Beckett's Babies.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. I'm big fans of the podcast.
We are thrilled to get to talk to you about Eureka Day, which we both just read yesterday. But before we dive into that, can you tell us what is your earliest memory when you were a baby?
The one that I think is the first is being in my crib, and my brother, who's 4 years older, is in the crib with me, and we're pretending to be lions. In my memory, like the bars or like the bars at the zoo. I don't know how old I am. Maybe I'm like maybe two, but that for some reason that's the memory that I have of that age.
That's so cute. And you said with your brother, is your brother older or younger?
He's 4 years older.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So how did you go from being that lion in the crib to starting to explore the world of theater?
I got into theater. I think I'd always liked doing, you know, skits and things in school. And then in high school, started doing plays. But I think it was much more about a sort of social thing than the sort of artistic bent. I think at the time, I was really into writing and literature, and I think I thought of that as much more of a sort of artistic interest and doing plays as more fun. And then it took many, many years for those things to kind of, you know, come together. But then I went to college, to New College, where I know you had a workshop, Sam, which is this very small college in Florida. That had neither a writing program or a theater program, because it was very tiny, and you would do a lot of sort of, you know, self-directed projects and tutorials, and we had no grades.
That sounds awesome.
it was in a lot of ways, but it also, it meant you were sort of on your own a lot. I mean, it meant that I did a lot of plays because you know, there'd be these sort of student-directed projects, and I directed a bunch of plays because you could initiate it, you know, that kind of thing on your own. But I, you know, it also meant I actually had like very little real theater education. but had done enough plays to know that I was not a great actor, and directed a bunch of plays in undergrad and decided I should be a director. And then I moved to New York because I figured that's, you know, what one does. And found that both like a really sort of exciting time and a really like difficult and disorienting time, because there was no real theater education, just like had very little sense about like contemporary theater or professional theater or the industry or any of those things, and was sort of very lost, I think. I sort of stumbled into kind of hanging around the like downtown theater scene at the time, like assistant directed a bunch of plays, like, ended up like right after I got to New York, assistant directing a play at Soho Rep. And that sort of then, you know, sort of led to a bunch of other things. But I just couldn't really, you know, at the time I felt really frustrated because I had no idea like how to make anything happen, or like any path to sort of go from where I felt like I was to where I thought I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. Looking back at that time, I feel like it was really super important, because I was absorbing so many things and just like being exposed to so much work and so many amazing artists. But that wasn't, you know, I don't think that was the experience of it. Or at least not completely. And then I one summer I did the Lincoln Center Director's Lab, and I met the woman who is now my wife, who was living in California, and we sort of ended up, you know, doing sort of a long distance thing, and I eventually ended up sort of following her out here, and that's how I got here to the Bay Area. And I think when I first came, I had this idea like in the back of my mind that I would, you know, maybe go back to New York. You know, who knew if this relationship was going to work out? But that like the Bay Area would be a nice place to like sort of like spread my wings a little bit more in less intense environment. My wife had just started a theater company, and so we sort of ran that theater company together. I mean, it still exists, actually. You know, it's sort of been around a long time, although it's kind of in a much more muted form than it once was. And I also, when I got here, I, you know, ended up starting to work with Playwrights Foundation, who are the organization that runs the Bay Area Playwrights Festival. And became the literary manager there, and then eventually the associate artistic director, and did that for a couple of years, and was sort of directing shows with my theater company and trying to be a director. And then sort of got to the end of that, sort of was ready, you know, was sort of done working at Players Foundation, and applied to grad school for directing, which I had done many years earlier when I was right out of college and didn't get in. And I did get in, but the program I got into would have meant taking out a ton of loans. And so I like had this sort of, you know, like moment of truth of realizing that I didn't really want to be a director badly enough, because I didn't want to go into all this debt to do it. And then I sort of had like a real moment of crisis. I like the next year I like applied to law school. And then at the very last minute, I also applied to this MFA playwriting program at San Francisco State, where I knew some of the people who taught there. And it's a very sort of, you know, very cheap, or at least was then, like a very cheap program if you were an in-state student, and really structured around people who kind of had other jobs. And I had like started writing a little bit right before that, but I don't think I had not even written a full length play.
But it was, it sounds like it was just a spur of the moment decision.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, because I had always like written when I was younger. Like I had the idea that I would like come back to writing, but I just sort of never, I hadn't like sort of didn't write for 10 years from like college. And then, and I had a couple things that happened. I had done this like devised piece with some other people and I had ended up writing some things as part of that and was like, oh yeah, writing's great. But I think because I had, I don't know, I was very like, I had a lot of anxiety about like telling anybody I was writing for a long time because I had, I don't know, been on the other side of it as like a sort of somebody who worked in like, you know, the literary manager in this like new play development organization or there can be. So it took me a very long time to like, I don't know, like say I was a writer. And really that was the sort of the best thing that happened in that MFA program was to sort of just like give myself like the space and time to start to think about myself as a writer. Mm-hmm. And I stopped, I think the first year I was in that program was the last time I directed a play. And I, and then it sort of just had like, that's kind of, shifted that direction and was writing and having work, just sort of developed in some opportunities in the Bay Area and continuing to run the theater company sort of intermittently. And that's kind of, and then I think, but was very limited, or at least it felt like in terms of sort of my opportunities to just the Bay Area. And then just sort of more recently, I think sort of with some of the things that happened around here today have sort of started to have more opportunities to work kind of around the country.
I would love to talk about your good day. First of all, wow. really enjoyed it. I'm so curious, like the moment, the ideas, the themes about it, and maybe really quickly sharing what's about for our listeners, what the play was about, what inspired you to write this play?
So the play is about, it's set at a private elementary school in Berkeley, and the characters are the board of directors of that school and the principal of the school. And it's a super progressive school where the board makes all of their decisions by consensus, and have all these progressive values. And then there is an outbreak of mumps, and there is, they struggle to find consensus around the idea of vaccinations and if they should, what the school policy on vaccinations should be, and everything sort of falls apart. And it's sort of the tragedy of, like, I don't know, in some ways, I mean, my favorite like encapsulation of the play that my friend Isaac Butler, who's a sort of critic and writer, said it's like a play about like the failure of the Obama years. Like the idealism of the Obama years being that, like, reasonable people on both sides can sort of come together and like reach consensus and we can all sort of move forward together. But that the reality is, like, if one side either is like operating in bad faith or just sort of believes things that you fundamentally believe to not be true, like if you're not operating out of the same baseline of reality, then you can't, like, you can't have a consensus because you can't agree. On sort of what the things are, so which I feel
like. Well, and I think what's so interesting about it too is that it's two very different sides, but they're in such a kind of microcosm community, that is a very small sector or small subset of the American population that like agrees on a lot of things. It's just that this one issue is very polarizing for them.
Right. And that was kind of the spark of the play in a lot of ways, is having this experience of talking to people in the Bay Area, people who are like, as smart or smarter than I am and super well educated, and like we have all the same politics, But then like this, you would realize like on this one thing, they seem to just like live in an alternative universe from you.
Yeah.
And like that is
which is very disorienting. It's so disorienting when that happens. I mean, totally. I'm thinking about, I was teaching at a high school a couple of years ago, and one of the other teachers at the school didn't believe in vaccines. And it was just like such a shocking moment for me to discover that somebody could be a teacher, like a teacher at a high school and not believe in vaccines, which I mean, kind of shows my naivete, I think. But it can feel like the ground is shifting underneath you when you feel like you're on the same page with somebody and you realize you're not.
Yeah, no, to like that, that's totally the experience.
So talk to us a little bit about the journey of this play. So you were inspired to write about people in the Bay Area. And how long ago did you write the first draft? And it seems like it's had a number of productions so far. So I think our listeners would be curious about just like the life journey of the play.
Yeah, so it started with this theater in Berkeley called the Aurora, where I had a couple of readings there over the years, had been like selected for this contest they used to have. So I had a little bit of a relationship with them, and there's this grant, I don't know if it still exists, but it would come around once every 3 years for playwriting, where like the foundation would commission a theater and a playwright with a pretty nice sized commission, but and a bunch of money for the theater, but the theater had to commit to producing the play before it had been written as part of the grant, which is a really awesome grant. I approached them about applying together, and had this like extremely vague idea that it would be something about vaccines, but that was sort of all I knew. And the Bay Area. And we did not get the grant, probably because I had no idea what the play was going to be about and couldn't articulate it. But at that time, they were just sort of taking what had been that like reading series, new play contest, and like shifting it over to be a commissioning program. And so they decided like this would be one of the first plays they would commission. Cool. So then I don't totally remember the timeline, but I do remember this like really palpable feeling of like not writing the play and having a lot of anxiety that I was like blowing this opportunity as I continued to not write the play over a longer time. And then, which was maybe, I don't know, maybe that was like 6 months or something. And then I sort of eventually, you know, and they were sort of very gently like check in with me to see how it was coming. And then eventually I mean, I feel like this is actually a great lesson that I have learned about process. Is it, my daughter, I have a almost 5-year-old daughter at that time, she was less than one. And I found it just very hard to find the time to write it. So I went away on this little kind of like self-imposed writing retreat for 3 days, you know, which my wife very generously allowed me to go on. And I remember coming home and like telling her like, ugh, I accomplished nothing. You know, like I didn't get anything done. And she was so angry at me because it was like, like such a burden, you know, to do that. And what I had done really is I had like, on that day, I'd done a lot of procrastinating and I'd done a lot of, like I made several like attempts to find a way into the play, but like none of them felt like they were going anywhere. But it's interesting because on one of them, in what was going to be this like much more surrealistic version of the play, I wrote what became, you know, the monologue that that Suzanne has kind of late in the play about Big Pharma and how, you know, the painkiller, it's just like what they've done with painkillers and vaccines. And like that ended up almost the same as I wrote it then, you know, in the play. And so I feel like a lesson that I have taken away and which I keep relearning is like, you know, the process of writing is not linear, and often like you might feel like you're not moving forward with something because you feel like you're hitting dead ends, but you're still like doing work in that time and it's still leading you somewhere.
That's so true. I can really relate to that. And a lot of times you're doing work with your subconscious mind.
Totally. Yeah. And so now when I like, you know, have had a period of days or something, and I will tell my wife like, oh, I'm so frustrated. I just got nothing done. And she'll be like, no, I know you're actually getting things done when you're getting nothing done. Because I, you know, struggle with procrastination. So then I, at some point, I don't remember exactly when I landed on it being a school, but at some point I did. And so I wrote, I don't know, a year after I got the commission, I wrote sort of either, I don't know if it was a whole draft or it was half the play, but some very terrible version of something that resembled the play, you know, and brought it in, and we sort of read it around the table with some actors. And that sort of started, you know, what was really just a super wonderful development process where like, periodically, I would have either like another draft or pages, and I would bring it in, and we would read it with actors either around a table, and then it sort of like grew as time went on. So then eventually we, you know, did a reading with like a day of rehearsal, and then we did a bigger workshop with a couple of days of rehearsal, and then, you know, did a workshop just on focusing on like trying to figure out how that Facebook scene was going to work. And sort of grew the play and had lots of conversations all along the way with the director who was on staff at the theater. And we sort of picked up the actors who ended up being in the cast through that development process. So like two of them who were in the production, you know, were there that very first day when we read the like terrible dregs of whatever around the table. The actors were then really like informed sort of how the play developed. And so by the time we got into the rehearsal room, it felt like everybody was really invested in the play and sort of had, you know, real investment in their characters. And it was really sort of just like, you know, sort of soup to nuts, like a wonderful development process, except for the how much I hated writing the play, which I deeply, you know, deeply hated. I had so much, I think I was trying to write a play that I thought the audience of the theater would like, but I had so much anxiety about feeling like this was not the kind of play that I like, that like it's just people like sitting in a room arguing about an issue and wasn't theatrical and wasn't, you know, and I really struggled to write it for a long time, and just kind of, I think had I not had like that support and encouragement of sort of the other people who are part of that process, I don't know that I would have been able to like see it all the way through.
That's so interesting to me.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that changed. Was there a moment when you started to love it? Or, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. I'm just kind of wondering about, because I've had experiences like that, and almost always I just give up on the project. Like I can't, and it's really difficult to move forward with something. Yeah. Where I feel like I'm writing it against my wishes, you know?
Yeah, I think I had a lot of fun in the rehearsal process. I think I still didn't know, like, what anybody would think about the play, but I was having fun sort of with those people and making it, and thought, like, it might be this like nice little gift for like this very specific community in Berkeley because it was such a Berkeley play. But I didn't. Yeah. I think until we had an audience, I didn't like know what to think of it. With this play, I've never had an experience, which is such an extreme example of how you don't understand how a play works until you have an audience. Because I like with that Facebook scene, which is for people listening, the board decides to do this like Facebook Live discussion with the whole community about what to do because they can't
so
gather
fun.
In person. So you're seeing the actors on stage, and then you're seeing all the comments from the people. And I think our anxiety all the way through when we were making the play was like, this theater has a very old audience subscriber base. Like, are they even going to want to read this text, or are they just going to ignore it completely and just listen to the actors on stage? And, you know, I was sort of making my peace with like, well, it'll still work if they only listen to the actors, like it's fine. And then that first preview we had, it was, you know, like the laughter was just like a wall of sound for the whole scene.
Yeah.
You couldn't hear, you couldn't hear a word on.
So, and for people who are just maybe haven't read the plan or just listening, my sense is that the comments as they're coming in kind of in real time are projected on a wall. Is that how you guys did it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So these are all the parents of the school who are, they start out with these kind of polite, philosophical disagreements. And then as the scene goes on, it just devolves into personal attacks. And, you know, of course there's a reference to the Nazis and it just continues from there.
Yeah,
it was such a, and I just remember like me and the director and some of the designers, like while that was happening, just like looking around at each other, like what the hell is going on? Because like none of us were expecting that and none of the actors were expecting that. So they were like hit with it. And then I had to sort of quickly go in and like cut a bunch of comments to make sure that you could still hear the lines that are important to hear in the scene. Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say that scene. I mean, I just love the contrast between, you know, what we're seeing the committee sort of like talking about the situation at hand. And then the parents like telling how they really feel, you know, and this like, it was horrifying, but like laugh out loud funny at the same time of just that this, I mean, I've been in like, Zoom meetings and stuff that's like large scale, and like I read the chats and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe people are saying this right now about the speaker or whoever it is. Like, I can't believe they're talking like this right now. And then there's just something about that you're talking about, the moments where you felt like, oh, it was kind of like you trying to, what's theatrical about people talking? But I think the way you presented it, it's just so theatrical because it's just feels so blown out. It's real at the same. It's real at the same time, but I'm like, I can't believe that. Oh, I can't believe it moment. You know, that feeling is just, it's so theatrical to me. Yeah, this real life, folks. This is real life. One other thing, I kind of just want to, you mentioned about the procrastination. And like the anxiety that came, the feeling about this play. And I relate to that because, and then I try to shift my mind that procrastination is like, I'm not procrastinating. I'm incubating in my own little
exactly.
world. Yeah. I mean, like these are really important ideas that, that's reflected in the play that it, and from what you're saying, the whole development process is just, it needed that time. It needed to, that collaboration with the directors and the actors and the listening. I like, it needed that because to read it now, I'm like, wow, so relevant. And I think even like 20 years from now, it's going to be still relevant. I think, I think so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. I mean, the other thing I feel like I learned from that writing process is, and I think about it a lot now, is that there is no correlation between like how difficult writing of a play is, how much you enjoy writing a play, mm-hmm. and how good that play is. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes plays come easy and sometimes they come hard, and that like that doesn't necessarily mean anything about how the product, what the product is. It's just like each one is its own thing.
Yeah, I think that's really mm-hmm. true. Which just goes to show that as playwrights, I think we're just really bad at predicting. Or like we're just too inside of a project to know how it's going to be received. Mm-hmm. And often I think we're bad judges of like how our work is going to live once we're done writing.
Yeah. I mean, I also just tend to like hate everything that I'm not actively working on. Mm-hmm. Everything. If I always find it really of a struggle to switch between projects because when I switch back to something, I have to go through this like several days of hating it And just like reading it, like the first day I know I will like read it and hate it so much I won't even be able to get to the end. And then like the second day I can like get to the end. And like then like by the third or fourth day I like am able to actually do some work on it.
Yeah. But first you have to kind of come to terms with like who you were when you wrote it and the headspace you were in. Yeah. So I want to switch gears a little bit. Can you talk to us about theater in the Bay Area? What's your experience been like there in comparison to New York? And for people who aren't familiar with theater there, how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, of course, like, I feel like there's a big, like, COVID question mark over everything right now.
Gosh, so yeah.
I feel like I can talk about it before COVID, I don't know like on the other end. But I think even then, it's really tricky to talk about because there's been, I think over the past couple of years, every major theater in the Bay Area, except for maybe two, has gotten a new artistic director or is about to. So it's just like a complete turnover of leadership, which is super exciting, but also means it's hard to know what it's going to be next because it's still, you know, you're starting to see people who've been there for a year or two, like what their seasons are looking like and what they seem to be interested in doing. But it, you know, a lot, I think, remains to be seen. But I think that is mainly really exciting because I think there's, you know, when people have been the artistic director of a theater for 30 years, like things get really calcified where they can. But then there's the other pressure, which I think is really negative for the long-term viability of the region, which is just how expensive it is to be here. Mm. And you really see that, I mean, even the change from when I first got here, where it was, you know, it's definitely cheaper to live here than New York. It was much cheaper to put up a show than in New York. You could, you know, and now I feel like I know a bunch of actors who've moved to New York because it's cheaper to live there. It's just, you know, the financial pressure that everyone's under, you can really feel it. I mean, like when we first started our theater company a long time ago, and you know, we had no money, and like as a result, like couldn't really pay anybody more than like $100 to do the show. You know, you could find a stage manager who just graduated from college to stage manage your show for $100. And I think now, when companies that are, I mean, maybe bigger than that, but are trying to hire a stage manager out of college, they have to pay them, you know, $1,200, $1,500 as a stipend, mm-hmm. because they need to pay their rent, which is insane, and they're working through other jobs to survive, and like that kind of. I really worry about what happens when you take away. I just think, like, when I first got here, I would have still felt like I could, in good conscience, if I was talking to somebody who just got out of school and was like, oh, I want to do theater, but I don't want to go to New York. And I would say, like, I could say, like, oh, Bay Area is like a nice place to go, like, spread your wings. And it's like the bar of entry is low. And I just feel like you would be insane to say that to somebody now. Like, no way should you go to the Bay Area. It's just too hard to live here.
That's so sad. I think that resonates with a lot of what I've heard, but it's sad.
Yeah. And I wonder, I really worry about what the long-term impact of that is on a theater community when you sort of take away like any of the new people sort of coming into the community, people who are not like independently wealthy. It's really worrisome. I think specifically for playwrights, I think the Bay Area is kind of interesting. I think there's kind of a lot of opportunity for playwrights just starting out. Like there are a bunch of different kind of play development organizations, and but then I think it's sort of there's a cap on that, and I think there's very like. I think once you get to the bigger theaters, there's historically been very little interest in like local playwrights and supporting local playwrights. So it's, I think that makes it tricky. I think it's really tricky to launch a career sort of from the Bay Area sort of to a more national career. You have to kind of get very lucky. and it's not, there's not enough theaters doing it. It's not like Chicago where like you could sustain yourself like just as a Bay Area playwright. So I think, yeah, it's sort of a mixed, I think it's like a great place to get started, but maybe not a great place to like be in the long term as a playwright, unless you, you know, have other compelling reasons to be here.
Okay. I feel weird. I'm just like, oh man, that's only cause like I, you know, I have family in San Francisco and friends in Veria and even when, even in college, so many of my artists that came were from the Bay Area and to like teach theater and stuff. And it's true. Everything you're saying is so true that the impact of, the cost of living and Silicon Valley and just everything that's happened the last decade or so, has really impacted the arts community. And, it's such a great town. Like, it's such a great city too. Like, you go in and you just like feel the energy like of the city, and I'm like so creative, and it's so like beautiful, and it's just the fact that the scene is it could be better. It could be better.
Yeah, and I will say like it is a great, you know, it's a great community of artists, and it's a very like welcoming place to new people. Mm-hmm. Like, I think, you know, when I, like, I remember when I was in New York, like, and you would just, like, to even try and, like, meet somebody for coffee that you wanted to meet, you just, like, it was really difficult. It would take, like, schedule with them, like, several months in advance or something, you know, and it was, like, when I came to the Bay Area and sort of, like, had this list of people who, I, you know, told me I should, said I should look up, like, everybody is super open and so that, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for that. Things are really tough right now. Like, and obviously COVID then only makes that, you know, so much more extreme. So we'll see. But I do, I mean, I do love the, you know, the community of artists that are here.
Well, and I wonder if this moment with COVID, and it sounds like there's a lot of new leadership, and maybe it'll just be an opportunity for a fresh start. And I'm just really interested to see what happens after there's a vaccine and we can all go back to the theater. If, you know, just if something will change, because what you're saying feels like the landscape of theater in a lot of places in this country. It's just not sustainable, and it hasn't been for a long time.
Yeah. No, I mean, I feel like it was a really intense, I mean, I feel like something that I understood intellectually, but understood it very different experiencing it. And then it was both like thrilling and depressing is like the relationship of New York to the rest of the country. Because then, you know, Eureka Day had this like quite small production in New York last year that was really seen by very few people because it was only like, it was a small theater and it had a pretty short run of only a couple weeks, but it did get a bunch of great press and it got a, you know, a critic's pick from Ben Brantley. And then like the moment that happens, a ton of, you know, theaters like want to do your play.
Yeah, that's just, and
that like, and you could have like the biggest, most successful production in the Bay Area and that would never, you know, you would maybe then one other theater wants to do it too, but you would never get that effect. I don't think. And so that's like, it's really, yeah, it's not great for the like the structure and landscape of American theater, but it is intense.
Well, let's talk a little bit about playwriting in general. So here's a question we've never asked anybody. It's a brand new question just for you, Jonathan.
Oh.
If you could have dinner with any three playwrights, living or dead, who would you pick and why?
Ooh. Let's see. I'll just say the first three people who pop to mind, and I think I'm limiting myself to 20th century, but I'll go Samuel Beckett,
Carol Churchill,
and Wallace Shawn.
Wait, who was the second one?
Carol Churchill.
Oh, Carol Churchill. Yeah. Good choices.
Carol Churchill.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like Churchill. I would probably be too intimidated to participate in that conversation, but I would like to be there for it.
If you're going to invite them to dinner, you have to talk to them.
That's true. I'd have to cook a really good dinner.
So why did you pick those three?
I mean, I think they, you know, I mean, I had a deep, deep love of Beckett for a long time. I think it was what made me first notice your podcast was the title. you know, I studied, you know, when I was in college, I did a year abroad at Trinity College in Dublin. It was the only like real theater classes I ever took actually were there. Cool. And to study at like the Beckett Center at Trinity College where they, you know, we did lots of like Beckett things and it was, like I took this Beckett class and they would like have somebody, like I think each week, whatever play we read, they would get some like Irish actor or director who had like worked with Beckett on that play to like come in and talk to us about it.
How did you not know about this Beckett Center? That sounds amazing.
That is amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Beckett Center is just like the drama department basically at Trinity College.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Carol Churchill is, you know, I think just the most, I mean, is the best living English language playwright, you know, and like her ability to like invent new forms and form that goes with content, you know, it's just, it's like, how does her brain work? I don't understand. You know? and then Wallace Shawn, whose plays I love, but also I just think is like such a fascinating thinker and talker and would just be like an amazing person to have in that conversation.
Cool. I'm going to be at that dinner.
But also somebody who's like politics are so like, who both is able to write these plays that like feel like on some level, like feel very gentle because they're sometimes just sort of these like monologue plays with like privileged people talking, but that like politics are so like intense and vicious and like urgent in his plays as well.
See, I have to confess, I don't think I've read any of his plays.
Oh yeah, you should read. You should definitely read some plays. I think The Designated Mourner is a good one to start with.
Okay.
And feels appropriate for our time as well.
And the class, or it's, I don't know if it's a was it a play? My Dinner with Andre. I just watched the film version of it, but I don't know if that was ever a play.
I think that was just the film, but I think it, you know, it's basically a play.
Yeah, because this is I'm talking. Okay, yeah, those are good choices. Like I would hang with those three in a dinner setting.
Yeah, me too.
Cool. Yeah. So to get a little more deep on the process, so I'm always curious of how you organize. Not because I watched the Netflix show Organize, Get Organized. But I did watch it all, but not because of that, but like, how do you organize your thoughts and getting into the page? Are you, you know, paper and pen person, note cards, outline?
I don't use paper and pen because I can't read my own handwriting. So it always ends up badly when I attempt that. You know, it's sort of different for each play. I almost never start with outlining. I will outline at a certain point in the process, depending, but I feel like I usually need to like, I would usually begin by like, just like making a couple different attempts to like find a way into the play. If I have some like vague idea. And so like writing some kind of scenes or dialogue, just like figuring out like what is the entry point. I mean, like for Eureka Day, my sister-in-law worked at a school that's very similar to the school in the play. And one day she was telling me about this like fairly contentious board meeting they'd had where they were debating whether or not to include transracial adoptee on the drop-down menu of races and ethnicities for admission. And like, as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh, now I know, mm-hmm. now I know how to enter this play. You know, and but then once I also I mostly am doing a lot more research than I used to with these days, I find, which is both like reading. I also, if it's appropriate, like to do interviews with people. I did a bunch of interviews for Eureka Day, and there's some stuff that comes directly from those interviews in the play. One of the things I did when I was living in New York is I assistant directed a couple of shows, like some of the first shows with this company called The Civilians, which do sort of documentary musicals mostly. And so, but sort of cool. Being around all of that, all of the, like that sort of interview based, kind of, you know, in a way of sort of like exploring questions, I find really appealing. And like the love of like when you have an interview with somebody, like the actual like strangeness of like human speech and like and character. But then once I feel like when I'm I will sort of do like very rough outline, I think, when I'm like maybe midway through a first draft and like have to figure out where I'm going and how I get to the end. And then but then when I am doing rewriting, I will then like break out the note cards and like try and like put different moments on note cards and lay it out and try and figure out. And then I also will have Word documents where I just like am asking myself a lot of questions that I'm trying to figure out about the play. Both like what is the central question of the play and trying to like keep honing that. And then also just like, what should happen, you know, a lot of A/B choices, like if I do this, then like how does that track through the play, or if that happens, like how would that track through the play, and just trying to like figure out which choice is going to kind of give you the most juice. But it's always, I don't know, it's always sort of different, I think. And I'm
when
not
you interview like, people sorry when you interview people, do you find that people are willing to talk? I'm also curious about when playwrights say they talk to people interviewing when you're for your research or for the play.
Yeah, I think people love to talk about themselves. I mean, you know, and their ideas. And as long as you like set it up in a pretty open way, like, and you sort of ask questions that, you know, just sort of prompt them to talk more. Generally people, you know, I think really, really like, you know, to people to have to listen to what they have to say. There is this moment in that I had so much anxiety because there is a monologue in Eureka Day, the one that the woman is talking about, you know, how we just, you know, like she's distrustful of vaccines because we have all this hubris as humans, and we've gotten so many things wrong in the past. And like that is very, not verbatim, but like very close to what had come out of, you know, this person that I had interviewed. And she came to see the play, and I had so much anxiety. I mean, I had told her like, oh, I, you know, use some of the stuff we talked about, but like, I had so much anxiety about what she was going to feel about like her words.
Right.
And about the character. And afterwards she was like, I loved it. She was like, I think what I have to say is so smart, and all these people were stuck in a room having to listen to it. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, when I realized what this play was going to be about, I did not think I was going to be able to empathize with the anti-vaccine contingent of your story. And by the end of the play, I really did empathize with them, and I was kind of amazed that that happened. Good job.
Yeah. I mean, that's been something really tricky to calibrate. And I feel like still is a thing I sort of, you know, I think you get feedback on, and you know, it's that thing where you get responses and you have to know, like, you know, to just like figure out like, well, some people are going to feel one way and some people are going to feel another, of like trying to calibrate to make it like to have empathy with that point of view, but not feeling like you are advocating for that point of view, or you know, the worst thing would be like somebody walks out of the play being like, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't vaccinate my kids, you know, like, and I mean, I don't think the play does that, but I think like, so, you know, I feel like there have been some reviews that are like, I don't know, maybe this is bad to even like voice this point of view at all, you know, and so like, so it's so tricky to know.
But I do think that's the job of the playwright is to show us how to wade around in those treacherous waters. Like it's, I think if you played it too safe, then the play would just be, well, I'm not even going to say preaching to the choir because I'm so tired of that phrase, but it would just be like, too self-assured, I think, if it was like, we're right and these people are wrong, you know, let's laugh at them.
Totally.
And so, and I really liked that I was able to see where every character was coming from and that they were fully realized human beings, you know, with reasons for why they felt this way.
So. Totally. So before we move on to Glistens, we have a final question we want to ask you. And this is a tough one. it's not that tough, but we'll see. so how would you define what it means to be an artist in the 21st century or in this moment of time?
September 2020 in America.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think it has to be something about like help, like trying to, give people avenues to try and make sense of the world in some way, because our world feels like it makes so little sense right now and like everything is falling apart. But I don't know. I mean, I think the like, I mean, at the same time, I guess I wonder if like, there's anything like fundamentally being an artist in this time or every time is not like, if the core of it is the same, which is like, you want to like, you know, dig at and discover something like that is like truthful and beautiful and share that with people. And hopefully like they connect to that truth and beauty and like, you know, helps people like feel more alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Easier said than done. I mean.
Definitely. Okay. Actually, one more question.
Okay.
So you mentioned that moment where you were directing and then that realization, like, you know what, you weren't admitting to others that yet that you're a writer. You know, what advice would you give to those people who are kind of, they think they're, you know, I'm a stage manager, or like I'm a director, but like they kind of, you know, maybe they are really a writer. What advice would you give to those folks that are kind of wanting to break into that?
I mean, I guess two things. I mean, one is that, you know, like what makes you a writer is writing. And so if you, you know, if you're not sure if you're a writer, then you should write. And if, you know, if you write, then that will be sort of be your path forward. And I do think everybody, I go back and forth about how, if I 100% believe this, but I think I mostly believe it, the like Paula Vogel thing that like everybody can be a playwright because everybody is a human and everybody has like access to human experience and a unique human experience. And like, that's what we want from people is like, an access to like a specific and unique experience, I think, from other people's plays. And I think the other piece of advice that I think about a lot, and the more I go along, the more true I find it to be, is from this playwright, this wonderful playwright, Rachel Axler, who mostly writes TV these days, but that like making a career is like, it's like being in a room with no doors and windows. And so the only way to get out of that room is to like burst through a wall. But that when you burst through that wall, that you are like one of those like Looney Tunes characters, and you leave a hole in the wall that's exactly in the shape of you, which means nobody else can go through that hole. And so like you can't,
I love
like,
that.
You can't follow anybody else's path because everyone's path is unique. And like, and I feel like when I was young, even not so young, like I used to do a lot of like looking at people's bios and trying to sort of like reverse engineer their career and like, oh, if I do X and it will lead to Y, then it will lead to Z. And I just feel like the more you know, see other people's careers like move over time and experience your own, you realize like everybody is so, the journey is so idiosyncratic to each person that like, that's not really a helpful thing to do and is more misleading than it is revelatory, I think.
That's so true. And it, you know, it's because there's so much that you can't control. And so, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's like you have to, the things that you think you're going to be able to control in your career are like exactly the things you won't be able to control. Right. Because you have to look for like other ways you can carve your path.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's both that there's so much you can't control. And also if you're looking at anybody else, unless you're like, they're your best friend and you know everything that's happened to them ever, like you're only seeing the tip of the iceberg and you don't know about all of the other things that happened.
Right.
And also everybody
writes in their bio all the things they got rejected from. That would be a really interesting way to start writing bios.
Right. Or like the random thing that happened, that like this led to that and this person said they liked your play and then 6 years later like this other thing came around, you know, like all of that kind of stuff. Right.
Well, shall we move on to glistens? So this is the part of our show where we talk about something from the week that stuck with us. Anybody want to go first?
I could go first. So this week, so much happened. Obviously the big one is RBG passing away.
I know.
I didn't want to mention on the show, but I was like, you know what? I have to.
We have to acknowledge.
Yeah. Acknowledge.
Yeah.
It's a huge, big deal. And I was in a spiral chaos in my mind.
Yeah.
And Sam left Instagram.
Oh my God, I can't believe that's your glisten.
I know. So much happened. Is it the last like 24 hours?
You left Instagram because of RBG?
Well, to be honest, it's like, it's just too, I think RBG was like the straw that broke the camel's back. It's just too much. And I just need a break. So I think I'll come back maybe after the election.
Okay. That's fair.
Maybe.
Don't use maybe, baby. Maybe. Okay. So my other glisten is that Hulu's Pen 15 is back. If you like that show, it's back. Second season. I love these girls. They are out of control. They are my spirit animals or whatever. I love them. And so, yeah. Oh, so also this month I have been trying to read as many plays as I can on New Play Exchange. A lot harder than you guys think. but the play that I really want to highlight this week from New Play Exchange that I got a hold of was Kadi Dadsevich's Red Bike. And I'm probably late to the party on this play, but this was really good. I by the end I was like, my heart was broken by the end of this play.
Yeah, you were texting me about this play.
Yeah, I was like, you gotta read this Red Bike. Yeah. But that's okay, so that's my glisten. It's a lot. So unpack that, people.
Well, I'll go next. I watched this film. The New York Film Festival is online this year. And well, I think they're also doing drive-in movies, but you can buy tickets and then during a particular window of time watch the film. And so I watched this documentary called Gunda or Gunda. I think it's Gunda, which is a Norwegian documentary about, I mean, don't laugh. It's just animals on a farm. Mostly this mother pig. You see her like give birth to these piglets and then nurse them and then like waddle around in the sunshine with them. And then I won't spoil the ending, but you can probably predict that it's pretty sad. And then throughout, there's also like cows and chickens. There's no words. There's not even a story. It's kind of like an anti-film in that it's really just like.
So your glisten is don't watch this movie.
No, it was. I was utterly enchanted by it. It's in black and white. And just like the, you're so close to these animals, you can see like the individual hairs on these infant pigs' backs. And the soundscape of it too is so rich. And so just like, I mean, they're like little puppies. You can hear all the snuffling and the grunting and the growling and squeaking. And it's just like a very rich, okay, I know I'm not selling it very well, but like... I loved it. That's my glisten.
If you want to feel like you're on a farm and you're like smelling these animals, watch this film.
Exactly. Jonathan, what is your glisten?
Well, my glisten was going to be being able to walk around outside and breathe the air, which we talked about that already. So I'll go with Cobra Kai, which is on Netflix, which is like it's sort of like a sequel is the right word, but it's a series taking up the Karate Kid 30 years later with the actors who played the main characters in the Karate Kid playing those characters now 30 years later. And The Karate Kid was one of those movies, like we had, you know, whatever, 15 or 20 movies like on VHS and that we would just watch over and over and over as a kid. And this was one of them for me. So a lot of nostalgia. But I actually feel like they do this kind of incredible job of balancing the tone of the TV series between like acknowledging like how incredibly goofy the source material is, while also like you know, making it sort of fun, and then it's also a teen drama, and they sort of invert like, you know, who's good and who's bad, and it's just like you keep like waiting for it to be terrible, but it is sort of surprisingly well done for what it is, and is just, although also like sends you down this like dizzying rabbit hole of like feeling so old because like these people are so old, and also there's like the meta thing of that, like for the characters in the show, the like main like the Daniel LaRusso and the guy who played Johnny, his like nemesis, that in the show, this karate tournament they had 30 years ago was like the highlight of their life. But also for those actors, the movie 30 years ago was the top of their career. So it's just like, it's sort of incredible that it like comes around like that.
That's hilarious. Isn't it in season two? Is it the second season? Two seasons, Yeah, I've been hearing some good stuff about the show, or people just kind of enjoying everything you just described about it. Fun.
Cool.
Before we sign off, Jonathan, where can our listeners find you?
I'm on Twitter, where I tweet angrily about politics mostly. And I do have a website that doesn't get updated very often. And I am on New Play Exchange as well.
And listeners should stay tuned for Eureka Day is going to be published.
Yes, I'm told it hopefully will be out in the next couple months.
Great. Okay.
Very exciting. Well, thank you so much for spending your morning with us and talking to us.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun.